I can tell you I'm very comfortable because we're already 20 minutes late. This is very American. The journalists are the same all over. As I said to somebody, like herding cats. I thought what the director general said was particularly about the air war was really important because it's been one of the things that has driven me crazy. Unlike the American command in the central command running the war in Iraq does not give out daily bombing sortie statistics. One flight by one plane is a sortie. We don't know how much tonnage is dropped. And we just, all of us in the international and the world press are very acquiescent and very agreeable about it. I've had communications from officers on aircraft carriers that are on duty that every day a tender comes with more bombs. We don't know how much is being dropped. We don't know how many tonnage. We don't know what the rules of engagement are, essentially. My guess is that an American unit taking rifle fire from an apartment building can call in, 500-pound bombs and destroy the building without warning the occupants in advance. I just don't know if that's true or not. That's my guess. And so just as something as basic as that is missing, and it's not just an American problem. I have to deal as an American with my country because I think I can get rid of the politics in maybe one or two sentences for you. Let's just say for the record that America, George Bush and Dick Cheney have made a number of military diplomatic mistakes in Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Pakistan, I'm just making a list, Somalia, North Korea, Sudan, we can keep on going, Cuba, Venezuela, Mozambique, Nicaragua, Yemen, Russia, et cetera. And I can explain it all in a sentence for all of you. It's my belief that after 9/11, I think Al-Qaeda took over the White House. That's just basically, I don't mean that literally, but I just think there's no other way to explain it. Just classic mistakes. But so we have to live with that as journalists. This is a reality. America is a reality for the whole world and how it moves and how it changes its policies and whether we have what happens in the next 20 months. There's not much we can do about it. We're not public officials. We're journalists. And so what's it all about? What are we here for? Why aren't some of us venture capitalists or academics? Why do we do what we do? And I always think about that a lot, about what a journalist is and what our goal is. And for me anyway, and I'm sure there's nothing special about what I'm going to say, I know that in my own personal life, in my family, whatever relationship you're in, whether you're married or any other relationship, it's about love. And of course, it's more really about trust. It's about having an enormous trust in someone else. And all of us as parents and as we don't want to lie to our children, and we demand that they don't lie to us. I would say with the exception of teenage girls for a year or two, but I have to be realistic. But and so all of us in our personal life, as we go through life, all of us around the world, with the same issues, we trust, love, respect, honor, integrity in our personal life. And instead of thinking about this in terms of the world, what we insist on in America, let's say, I can speak about that directly, what I insist on and what I live, the way I live my life personally and what the values I have, the requirements particularly of honesty and integrity, I don't begin to, this is what I demand from my family and from myself, I don't begin to ask of my government. In other words, I've come to learn as I've come to age in the Vietnam War. I've been around for a long time. And as I've come to learn that, I've learned that the National Security Advisor and the President of my country, who have the right to take my children and draft them in the army and send them off to kill and be killed in the name of democracy, I've come to understand that they're not honest. They don't tell the truth. They don't let, I'm talking about Kissinger and Lyndon Johnson and McGeorge Bundy and the war after war and deceit after deceit we've learned to come with, live with. If some of you might remember, the Pentagon Papers were published at the height of the Vietnam War. They were released by Daniel Ellsberg, and they showed a 10-year pattern of systematic lying by the presidency. And certainly in the last 6 years, we've seen a collection of wrongheaded and misrepresentations by the government that equal anything in Vietnam, much worse, I would say. So we have a disconnect. What we insist on in our own family, we don't begin to expect of our leadership. That's just a reality. That's a reality around the world. It's not just in America, but the leaders generally, in the Middle East, for sure, certainly in some of the leading Sunni countries, the moderate Sunni countries, whoever, there you can say, I was just in Cairo for the other week, and if you go travel outside of the very wealthy central area, you can see the total poverty and the lack of care and the leadership of that country is more abject, and is, I would argue, it comes close to, you know, it reaches a pinnacle of indifference to the society. And so when you're faced with that, you begin to understand what our profession is all about, because what we can do is we can do something that must be done. We don't do it enough. We must hold the leadership to the highest possible standards. We must start holding them to the same standards we hold in our families. That's the way I look at it. The way I look at presidents and generals, 4 stars or 3 stars, I say you have to behave to your people, to the leadership, to your leaders. You have to behave to us, to all of us, the same way I want my family to behave. So I think we have become, given the general collapse of integrity and leadership among the world's leaders, and this is something the Director General is alluding to, I think indirectly, there are places that the leadership is better, but by and large we've had a collapse of serious leadership, political. We've always had craven politicians and corruption, but I don't think we've ever had such a colossal failure as we have right now. And who's going to fill, whose job is it? I don't want to idealize what we do, because what we do is very imperfect. But that's our job, and that's what that's for me what this profession is all about. This profession is about we deciding. Most people go into journalism, as I said, they could choose much more lucrative forms of running their lives. We go into it because we think we can make a difference, the good ones, the ones that are here. I think most of you here will want to, and I certainly think this is something Al Jazeera has been doing around the world in ways that has never been done before, much unappreciated in America, but it doesn't matter. It isn't a question of what America thinks or American journalism thinks. It's a question of what's really going on. And so all of us, we have this horrible job as the world collapses around us, as leadership collapses, as we're driven more by the price of oil than the price of integrity. We have a function to role about to play, and that's, to me, that's what it's all about. I complain bitterly. I was just talking earlier today. We have so many terrible shortcomings in our profession. We're very bitchy to each other. We're competitive. We're very narrow. There's a young journalist here, Dar Jamal, whose stuff has been very prescient in some, and I've 4 or 5 times included a grave accounts of some of his work in my stories. And editors, it's not just at the New Yorker, it's at the New York Times, where I worked very happily for a decade. The first thing you cut out is any mention of anybody else. And that's such a disagreeable aspect of our profession that the competition, rather than credit a competitor, we'll ignore the story. And this is general. We all know what I'm talking about. When I was a young kid covering the Vietnam War for the Associated Press in the 1960s, I learned to hate the war on the job training. I thought the war was the gravest disaster, and you couldn't get promoted to colonel in the U.S. Army unless you were a professional liar. I just thought it was, and yet, if somebody in the Los Angeles Times had a great story, I would be one of the first to run to the press officer in the Pentagon and say, where's the denial? So I could write a story, the Pentagon denied today. The competition we'll never get rid of it, because that's part of our profession. But it's the most unattractive part. The part that's the most important is the part I was just talking about, which is the part that we somehow because of, as horrible as it is, 24-hour television, 24-hour cables, internet, there's so many bad things that go on. But it also offers so many more potential, so much more potential. If we had started the war in, as you know, there's channels right now, internet, some of the insurgencies in Iraq have their own channels, their own internet addresses that one can pick up a great, if one in America cared and knew the language well enough, we could learn a great deal. So it's changed. The world's changing so quickly. Saddam Hussein, I think, in 1991, if it was today, he would have his own. When the war began in 03, we would have been able to watch it from his point of view on cable. That's going to be the next war. It's going to be harder, I think, for the kind of abuses that are going on right now in Iraq. I think to be played out in future wars, because I think there's going to be more media attention, more media visibility. Right now, it's not great. So I just think we have a funny calling in our profession, which is right now, we restate it. I can't say it enough. We have to play the role of the responsible parent because the government doesn't do it, particularly my government right now. And the media get this tremendous pressure on us, and and I think it's there. I was in Cairo because Mohammed Haykal had me come and spend 2 days. He has a new foundation. I spent it with about 70 journalists who wanted to be investigative reporters. And we spent 2 days. We didn't talk about, it wasn't about the war in Iraq. It wasn't about what's going on in America. It wasn't about even what's going on between the Palestinians and the Israelis. It was about, tell me how to do a story. And what do we do? What's the modality? What do we say to our editors? And there were 70, I came away thinking that Mubarak or whoever replaces him, his son or whatever, is going to be facing, in 10 years, I think, Egypt may be a much better place. It's either going to be a better place, it's going to be a much worse place, because the journalists are going after them. The integrity that I saw, most of them, more than 50% of the journalists who were there at the seminar were women, cutting edge. And that's another element, as we see more women participating, particularly in this world, in the Arab world, in newsmaking. I think it's going to change. I think it's going to change much more for the better. And I think the press and the bloggers in Egypt will put much more pressure as people like my country and others fall away from whatever words we talk about democracy. Of course, those words fell away very quickly. So I say forget the governments. We can brood and brood about how bad my government and other governments have been and what's going to happen next. But our job is to forget about it and do what we can. We are the quasi-government. I don't want to overdo it. There's nothing noble about us, as I say. This is why I come to these meetings and why I went to Cairo, because I think it's very important that the next wave really be effective. And I can also tell you, as everybody knows from what happened in my country after 9/11, I think generally it's fair to say that the American media did not do well, even though we're the most progressive and we can all speak out against the government, even today without fear of reprisal, which isn't true around the world, as we've heard. And so I welcome the chance to come here and listen. I also promise that I want to hear questions because I think you have a chance to ask anything you want. And I don't want to take – I've already done 20 minutes. And I don't want to run long because we're going to be hopelessly late as it is anyway. The conferences with journalists are notorious. So why don't somebody just ask me a question? Let's just do some questions for the next 20 or so minutes. And we can get into any specifics you want about anything.
بالفعل نشكر السيد هرش على هذه الكلمة وندعو الآن الحضور الكريم من المشاركين لمن يرغب في طرح أسئلة على السيد هرش فقط نذكر بأن كل متدخل أمامكم 4 ميكروفونات موجودة أمامكم بإمكانكم التدخل بصفة مختصرة تكون الأسئلة مباشرة وقصيرة وقبل ذلك يعرف كل متدخل عن نفسه والجهة التي ينتمي إليها ما من أسئلة؟ هل يعقل؟
You're not getting any. Nobody wants to ask a question. Were you all of a sudden intimidated? Were you just bored, or what's going on here? Come on. We're journalists.
I'll start off, Danny Schechter with Media Channel. Sai, you've been reporting on various threats against Iran, suggesting that a war plan is in effect by the United States against Iran, predicting that conflict will spread to Iran. What do you say now? How do you see that unfolding?
Is this being simulated? This being translated in time? Do I have to wait? Are we okay? I don't have this on.
Yeah.
The Iranians have been around for thousands of decades, weaving rugs. Very patient. They're tremendous negotiators. I think anybody to think there's something casual in what they're doing right now with the British prisoners is a mistake. I think it's well considered. I can give you one thesis. I think the leadership in Iran, there's been a lot of talk in Washington in the last month or two that the Iranians are on the run, that Washington has effectively cut off economic, we've been squeezing them economically, we've been squeezing them with the International Atomic Energy Agency, we've been squeezing them with the, also with the sanctions in the UN, that they're hurting, that they're worried, that Ahmadinejad's in trouble, that the Supreme Leader is on his deathbed. This is the story going on in Washington. And so I think what you're seeing is, if I'm the Iranians and I decide that maybe Washington is coming after me, I'm going to say, bring it on. Do it on my time. You want to come? Come. I'm giving you casus belli. I'm grabbing some prisoners. I thought they released them in a day or two, but keeping them this long is becoming provocative. It's deliberately so. It could be they're simply calling our bluff, saying to, as you may know, Mr. Blair, in the Bush made a speech in early January that basically renewed his threat. Despite all the talk about diplomacy, you also have Mr. Cheney, particularly on his trip to Australia, and you had him saying, all options are on the table. And Blair initially 2 months ago, 2.5 months ago, was very outspoken in his anger at Iran over the nuclear issue. And I will tell you again and again that in the American intelligence community, there is none evidence of a working bomb or even a serious secret parallel secret program. It doesn't matter how many times you write it or say it. It's still, that's the wonderful thing about being king or president. You can say things again and again, whatever the truth is, and it gets reported. But in any case, I think Blair certainly seems to be backing off, and I think there what the Iranians may be doing is saying, don't make the mistake of underestimating us, and don't think that we're not prepared to accept what you want to do. We're ready. I think that's a strong possibility. I have no information. I'm just giving you a sort of heuristic point of view. I will tell you that those people who think you can simply bomb Iran do not understand some of the military complexities. We have a fleet in the Straits of Hormuz, which is, until 1990, no American aircraft carrier ever went into the Straits for simple technical reasons. It's a carrier has very limited maneuverability. It needs a lot of room. Once it launches, it always has to recover its airplanes, and the planes have to be flying into the wind. The wind patterns are predictable, very predictable in that part of the Gulf, as you all know here. You have certain times, certain winds, certain directions. And if you're the Iranians and you have as many as 1,000 small boats that could be converted into suicide boats, Boston Whalers or PT boats, the Revolutionary Guards have been using these boats to smuggle for almost a decade and a half now. And so you have a formidable force against an American aircraft carrier. You have an aircraft carrier that, once it's recovering its airplanes that have been launched, has to move in predictable ways. It has to be into the wind. You will know where they're going before they know where they're going. They're vulnerable, and that's why carriers never went in there. And the other reason you cannot just do something with bombing is that the Iranians have very sophisticated new military guidance systems for their weapons, for their Exocet and Silkworm missiles. Most of them are along the coast. If you're going to start a war with Iran, you have to send Marines in on the ground into the various islands along the Gulf and the various ports there where there are missile depots, and you have to take them out by hand. You cannot trust air bombing to do it. So that's why the Americans have an MEU, a Marine unit there called the Boxer. It's on duty now, 1,800 Marines ready to go. So it would not just be a sanitary air war, as the director general was saying. You know, the air war is perceived by the media and by most of the world as very sanitary. Just a bunch of guys in there, you know, silk scarves waving, canopies open. I always love that image. When I was a kid growing up in Chicago, during World War II, my sisters on Saturdays used to take us to the movie house to watch the American propaganda movies about the world, about fighting the Nips, the Japanese. We called them the Nips, and the Krauts were the Germans. And in the movies I saw, we had a bunch of American pilots. These are all old names: Robert Mitchum and Richard Widmark and Robert Ryan and Van Johnson were the heroes of 4 decades ago. And they would be fighting over a nurse one night, and the next day they would be up flying against the Japanese Nips. And the Americans in the movies I saw, in the P-51s, the canopy was open, no headgear, and they would, you know, as I say, scarves, they'd all be going thumbs up to each other. The Nips always had the canopies closed, and they had these little helmets, these leather helmets over their heads, sort of, and they were squinting. And at a critical moment, one American would come and kill the Nip, would shoot a Japanese plane, was going to kill one of the American heroes, and another one who had been fighting with him the day before over a girl would come on his tail and say, "I'll save you," and bullets would come into the cockpit, and we'd watch the movie, and we'd be in there'd be a cockpit. To look at it now would be silly because of how primitive the movies were, but we'd see the Japanese soldier with his little helmet, and the bullets would come in, and the plane would start going down. And just before it hit the water, there'd be a trickle of blood out of the corner of his lip, and we'd all cheer. Hit the water and he'd die. And that's what, you know, were we propagandized? If some of you have read Paul Fussell, a Yale professor, has written about the propaganda that was used on the Americans in World War II, how certain pictures were kept away and certain images. And now you don't have censorship, but you have a collective censorship. Again, you were hearing about it earlier this morning, an inability to look at certain pictures of what bombs do or what bullets do. We are so susceptible, all of us, to propaganda, and there's so much more, and as innovative and as brilliant as the new systems are, the email and the internet, don't forget governments also have innovative and creative ways of using them too, to educate the people too. So we're in a war, we're in a struggle for truth versus propaganda. I'm very much, generally very much anti-government. I think governments have failed us, and I think we have a burden. I keep on coming back to that. I think that's the noble cause we're all striving for. That's why we do what we do, because we're trying to make it better for everybody. We're not interested in ourselves. It's trying to make it better. That's a long answer to a question, but so what? Yes. Now you're getting less shy.
For those who want to ask questions, there's 4 microphones, of course, just to remember, and 2 wireless microphones also. Yeah.
Yeah. My name is Nuruddin Miladi. I teach media studies and sociology at the University of Northampton in the UK.
I can't say that again. You teach where?
Media studies and sociology at the University of Northampton in the UK. Well, I'm talking in English, so I don't need the answer.
I'm so proud of I can actually figure out how to use it. This, for me, is technologically very advanced. Go ahead.
Fantastic. Now, talking about the way the media covers the Middle East, there has been huge discrepancies between what Arab media, the way Arab media covers the war in Iraq, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and other conflicts, and the way Western media does. I've got 2 questions in relation to this. The first one is, Do you see broadcasters from the East or the West able to be impartial, objective in what they report?
Are you kidding? Are you kidding me? Are you asking that question seriously? Of course not.
The second is it possible to come to a kind of consensus or international understanding about what is impartiality, what is objectivity, what is kind of neutrality in covering the world around us? Because I'm talking here about a kind of very obvious discrepancies, very obvious misunderstanding between what we see from the West and the East. And I live in the UK, and I know what I mean by when watching the BBC, for example, Channel 4, ITV, and many other channels in the UK. And you compare that to what you see on Al Jazeera and now what you see on Al Jazeera English. Huge discrepancies, huge differences. How can we make a marriage between these differences and come to a certain consensus in relation to this? Thank you.
If you think there's going to be a consensus between East and West about any given fact, I will tell you that perhaps there might be, but only in Plato's Republic. It's simply that you're kidding yourself. It's not going to happen. There's always going to be racism, sexism, political differences. There's always going to be enormous, in the United States of America, nobody knows who Hassan Nasrallah is. When he made a major speech 2 weeks ago, not one newspaper carried a word about it. There's no perception. Most people in America barely know where Lebanon is, let alone they know who Aoun is and what's going on there, the difference between Aoun and Sin. You know, it's just a fact of life. And what they do know is colored by the government. And so my government, and of course, we're awfully, the average citizen is exposed to enormous propaganda and misleading information. And there's also, as I said, there's racism, sexism, there's hatred of, there's xenophobia, constant, chronic. The best you can do is do this and chip away at the edge, to not do anything, to acquiesce. Is to give up. You cannot give up, but you must understand the difficulty of what you're doing. Al Jazeera, which has enormous influence outside of America, has none inside of America. Very little. Although most of the Arab people I know in Washington, anyway, perhaps we're talking about a select group. Everybody who speaks Arabic gets DirecTV, so they can watch what's going on. And I remember during some of the wars in Fallujah, the second battle, I would run over to my friend's house and insist they translate what's going on now, because there was a crew there and no American reporter was near it. So you've got a totally different view. But of course it's going to be always awful. From your point of view, it's going to be devastating, racist, horrible, enervating, discouraging. Da. The answer is da. Of course that's a reality. And so you accept that reality and you work within it. All you can do is chip away. It's very difficult, but don't have illusions that suddenly some miracle is going to happen and East and West are going to understand each other. What you can understand is that you can understand why some of the smart people I know thought Bush had the win again in 2004, because the American people had to go to the bottom with him to understand how bad it was. And so there were people who said he had the win. A Democrat could not govern until the American people came. So there's been some progress. The American people, for the first time, are coming to terms with what's happening. I'm talking about the average person. We see the polls showing they're against the war. This has all happened in the last year. Of course, it's because, you could argue, it's because there's no victory. And certainly it is. But you're seeing some significant changes among the average American that you wouldn't get otherwise if they hadn't been there to watch it firsthand. And out of this may come a growing sense that there is a world out there and that what we do impacts on it more and more. And that's useful, very useful. That's just a step. But what you want talking about is a nirvana that won't come in our lifetime. There's always going to be an enormous discrepancy. Enormous. We are just talking... for the life of me, I don't understand why the American... cable channels don't want Al Jazeera there, but that's probably, I would guess, just through some, if not direct government pressure, indirect. But you'll see that breakthrough. People will start letting them in, because when you have a disaster like we have, you need information. But I have no optimism at all that East and West will ever really understand each other in our lifetime. So what? So what? You just work with what you have, and you don't, I just think that's very practical. I don't want to five more minutes. Somebody tell me the time. It's, you know, as usual with reporters, it's screwed up. Like herding cats, I said, dealing with the press.
Continue. We do have time.
Okay.
So we will take another question. Yeah.
Yes, go ahead. Yes, sir.
Oh, great. Thanks.
You two are fighting? East and West right here?
In the right place.
Don't defer to the West. Go ahead, East.
No, we start to take the...
Go ahead. You go first. Let the Americans go next. wait, let me. Hold on. I've got two of these. Which one works?
محفوظ ممكن تقرب شوي.
Go ahead.
محفوظ قرطي صحفي بالموقع الإلكتروني للجزيرة. أنا لدي سؤالان في حول طريقة تعاملكم مع شؤون الشرق الأوسط. في غالب القصص التي كتبتموها مؤخرا عن الشرق الأوسط كانت جل مصادركم كانت أمريكية. هل تعتقدون أن هذه الاعتماد على مصادر أمريكية في الغالب هل هو كافي لإعطاء صورة دقيقة وقريبة من مجريات الأمور في الشرق الأوسط؟ السؤال الثاني، هل إلى أي حد أنتم دائما متأكدون أن الاعتماد على المصادر الأمريكية وحدها دائما غير خاضع أنتم لستم ضحية للتلاعب، خاصة في ظل الصراعات والخلافات بين أجنحة مصادر اتخاذ القرار في الولايات المتحدة؟ وشكرا.
شكرا محفوظ. We'll try to take the other question in the same time.
Those are great questions, but the actual fact is that I do deal quite often with people in the countries about which I'm writing. It's just often much more difficult to get into who they are, because America, as love it or not love it, is free in terms of the media. We have our problems, but you can, you know, nobody is following me, and at least that I know of, and nobody is repressing me. We have tremendous freedom, but often people in countries that I report on have more difficulty. So I try to, I spend a lot of time, I've probably made, since December, 4 trips to the Middle East. I spend much more time. That doesn't mean often I have the same problem. You're dealing with sources. I have one luxury, because I've been around so long, and because I have a record of somebody on the inside can come to me with something and know I can make it better. They know I have other people that can take their information. You know, there's about Abu Ghraib, for example. Abu Ghraib is only the tip of a real serious problem that I've also written about. Again, you know, often my stories are ignored in America, much more attention here, outside of America than here. We have a systematic problem of abuse that began within a few months of 9/11. Systematically ordered from the top under the most secret conditions, secret prisons, that are still exist despite what the government says. And so people on the inside know they can come to me, as I say, and I have the ability to take a piece here and go to other people inside and make it better. And so that makes me feel comfortable about what I do. Yeah, but you're right, there's always a grave question, and it's always raised, particularly among my colleagues in America, about unofficial sources and unnamed people. But I've been doing the same thing. You know, it's raised more at the New Yorker than it is, for example, when I worked at the New York Times, it did the same thing. So unnamed sources are, you cannot exist in our profession without having the ability to get the trust of a senior official who will tell you the truth, and particularly somebody in the government who's telling you something that's against the policy. But I always, of course, I'm heavily tilted towards American sources. That's where I live. But writing about Lebanon, for example, I've probably, I've seen Nasrallah maybe 4 or 5 times since the war began. Only the last time did we talk about Lebanon. Most of the time we would talk about Iraq, because I was telling someone the other night, he is without question. Whether my Americans like it or not, he is one of the most important and visionary figures of our time. He is really a pretty amazing person. And why the United States would prefer him to become a terrorist rather than become a player in the government in Lebanon is beyond belief. That's just a big mistake, one of many we make. But I'm sensitive to your issue. I can't deal with the question of secrecy in America, but I certainly make an effort to see, and every time I go someplace, I like to see and talk to foreign leaders. I always do that, and mostly sometimes privately, but you get a sense. You get a sense, and in this world, by the way, it's also very possible because they're very open in this world, the smart ones and the good ones, particularly in the Gulf states, because they're scared to death, as they should be. Yes. We'll just do these two, and then
Mr. Hirsch, we'll try to take the two questions.
Okay, we'll take these two. There's a panel I'm dying to hear, so I want to get to it. Let's go.
Yeah.
Hi, Mr. Hirsch. Ethan Zuckerman with Global Voices. I was thrilled to hear you mention the role of bloggers in reporting from Egypt, and it's obviously an increasingly important group of people there. We're discovering that speech online in Egypt has some really harsh consequences, and we've seen Karim Suleiman now facing a 4-year prison sentence. We've seen other bloggers be regularly arrested. I'm wondering if you see a future in which professional journalists will start becoming advocates for the protection of rights of speech online for citizen media, and how you see that that movement emerging.
That goes into the question of whether one journalist would ever acknowledge the existence of some other journalist who may be doing better at what he does. That's just against the grain. As I said, we're very bitchy to each other. We're just very nasty to each other. It's almost tribal, jungleistic, if you will, animalistic, a turf. But in Egypt, it's particularly important because, as you said, it's the bloggers. Right now, the bloggers are doing a great job challenging some of the statistics of the recent election there. And so the bloggers, but what you'll see, I think, increasingly, what I came away from, I came away with such optimism after being with the just rank-of-the-mill, some of the regional journalists and some bloggers, but many other television people, radio people from not only the Cairo newspapers, from around the country. There's a tremendous desire brought on because of the increase in information. You know, people like me, and I don't mean that, I'm not suggesting I'm a role model, but there are people who are doing things that they want to do in Egypt. And that's one reason Heikel brought me there, is to make that point. So you're seeing, why should I be able to talk to the head of Egyptian intelligence anytime I want? Not that I can, but theoretically, why should I be able to and they can't? Why should I talk to a military officer and they can't? And so these rules are being broken. Things are changing. Bloggers are important. They're also very sloppy, very imprecise. And there's a lot of crazy stuff on bloggers, and both right and left, vitriolic stuff. But in general, it's new, and it's going to take time. But it's increasingly very interesting. And so, this whole media explosion, we all scream about 24-hour cable television in America. We're talking about Fox News and CNN, who diminish news by this rapidity of what they do. But in general, it's tremendous opportunity and tremendous increase in information. It's very exciting now. And we'll see these governments, the autocratic governments. My country may talk about democracy, whatever that is. I used to cover civil rights. And one of the first people, when I was a young reporter for the Associated Press before the war, in the early 60s, I covered civil rights, and I was covering Martin Luther King, the famous who has to explain Martin Luther King. And he once said to me, after a terrible march in Chicago where people pilloried him and threw stones, he said, "You cannot give freedom to people who don't want it or understand it or know it." That's the same with democracy. But, you know, go tell that to my president. Last question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Seymour Hersh. Thanks for you. Sorry, I don't have time. للأسف شديد نضطر إلى إنهاء هذه الجلسة لضيق الوقت. الآن أدعو الزميل راجح عمر ونبدأ مباشرة أول جلسة خاصة في هذا المنتدى. هذه الجلسة تتعلق بصحافة العمق. أدعو الزميل راجح عمر ليقدم هو أيضا بدوره ضيوفه الكرام.